This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. My guest today is truly a legend, the one and only Dion DiMucci. Dion?
Bob, it's a pleasure to be with you. Good to be here.
Okay, you just put out two Christmas singles. What's the story with that?
Well, the first one I wrote was You Know It's Christmas. And I was sitting around with a couple of friends of mine, and we were saying the world could really use a shot of some love and harmony and transcendence and peace and serenity, or some togetherness. Or, you know, we were just, I said, Christmas is the grace that changed my life. So I'm going to write a Christmas song. So I thought, now what does a blues man do, or a rock and roller do when he writes a Christmas song? You know, there's a bragging tradition. You know, I'm from the Bronx. So I like, you know, like the Wanderer. You know, it's like a bragging tradition. So I wrote a song about a guy that bought his girlfriend the perfect present. And he can't wait for her to open it, because he can't wait to see the look on her face. You know, he you know, and that happens only once every 20 years. You get the perfect gift. So that's what the song is about. So then when Joe Bonamassa heard it, he said, Dion, man, you are prolific. You just keep cranking them out. I want to play on this. So he joined me, and we made a little video, and I did the song with a few friends of mine, and it was just a lot of fun to do, you know. The second song, again, I just thought, you know, we need something to bring us together, you know, and Christmas is my favorite holiday. Something about, you know, life is about giving, and that's what Christmas is about, you know, and I try to keep the spirit all year round. It's the spirit of true charity, you know, like just giving with it, you know. So I put this song together, and welcoming Christmas and sharing it with people. And when I finished it, I just thought of Amy Grant. I've known Amy Grant since she was 19 years old. I met her when she was 19, fell in love with her voice. She had the song El Shaddai and My Father's Eyes. And so we've been friends all these years. I just called her up. I said, Amy, I have a song. And she heard it, and she said, Dion, I love this type of thing where you don't plan. It's just in the flow, you know? And she says, yeah, I'll do it. So she smiled through it and knocked it out, and just she made it something sublime. I thought it was good when I finished it, but she really, it shows you how limited I am. You know, when an artist, any artist, you get somebody that distinctive like Joe Bonamassa or Amy Grant, they just infuse a track that I did with such wonder. They make it sublime.
So how do you know Joe Bonamassa?
Joe, it's crazy. His manager must live about, he's in walking distance from me. His manager, Roy Weissman. And I was walking one day around the lake and I met Roy Weissman and we became friends. I have a lake over in my neighborhood here. It's like a mile and 2.2, you know, so we walk around and we have some great conversations. He says, Joe's coming into town, and Joe comes over the house, you know, and he's just a regular guy, likes to pick up my guitars. We like to talk about the blues and the history of what we're doing and the roots of it. And we resonate, you know, with the same artists, a lot of the, what connects what we're doing, you know, from the 30s and 40s and, you know, American roots music. And
this album, you know, we're in COVID era. So how did you actually do the recording? Everybody recorded in their own space and then you put it together?
You know, I put this album together. It was complete. It seemed like the day I finished it, we went in shutdown. I think like somewhere in March. I had finished
this is your
the album.
Blue. This is the album, not the Christmas tracks.
No,
this
not
is the
Christmas
album track. With all original and all the special stars.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's called Blues with Friends. And I tell you, it's crazy, Bob. I know we started out talking about the Christmas songs, but I went in, I had these 14 songs that I had accumulated over a few years because I was working on a play and I never went into the studio, but I had some time. I thought, let me go in and cut these things. So I go into the studio. I knocked the 14 songs out in 2 days, just me and my guitar.
Well, now, is this a studio in your house or you use a local studio? What'd you use?
A friend of mine has a studio right down. I say a studio. It's a room in his house. He has all the equipment, high-tech equipment. I sat on a folding chair, took my guitar. He says, sing them like you sing them in your house. I took the guitar out. I went through all the songs. I went through about 8 songs the first day. The second day I came back, I knocked out about 6 of them. So I started, brought in a bass player, drummer, keyboard, you know, Rhodes. I love Rhodes.
Piano. Yeah, great sound.
Yeah, I just love that. So I built up some tracks, and then I had something. I said, man, these things are great. This is something special. I really felt it was, you know, I know how to write a song. I know how to make a record. But then this started, something I've never experienced before. Again, Joe Bonamassa started it. I think he's the catalyst. I think it's fair to say that, you know, he gave me the vision for it because he heard Blues Coming On, one of the songs on the Blues with Friends album. And he heard it and he said, Dion, I got to play on this. So I said, be my guest, man. You know, Joe Bonamassa, this guy's mesmerizing, masterful, you know, monster guitarist. I said, yeah, play. I never knew what he, listen, Bob, this is the thing about this. It's like, I usually get a guitar player to come into the studio and you go, yeah, give me this, give me that. And he plays, you know, and he fills the track in. But you, when you ask an artist, you don't know what they're hearing. They're very distinctive. It's like they come up with something that's not even on your radar. So he picked up a slide guitar. I mean, you know, he started playing slide on it, and which I didn't hear. I really didn't hear slide on it. But when he started playing, what I was hearing was almost like a horn section. Like you could hear in his playing, you think you're listening to the Apollo theater band with headed by Miles Davis and John Coltrane, with King Curtis, you know, on the side, but because he's playing this stuff and it's just crazy good, you know. It's fascinating what he did. So I'm listening to this thing in my house. I'm thinking, what the? This is something really special. I mean, I thought the song was good, just the record I'm trying to make, but he made it something special. It's like you go to the Olympics to jump 19 feet at the pole vault, and I don't know, some wind takes you 23 feet and you break the world record, you know. So that's the way it felt. So I then, as I started listening to the tracks, I said, you know, I told Wayne Hood, who is the engineer, co-producer with me, I said, Wayne, I think I'm going to call Patty Scalfa for this song, Him to Him. She has that Jersey soul. She's like the Jersey soul girl. She'll add something to this song. I know it. So I sent it to Patty, and I thought, here's the deal, Bob. This is the great part about why this album was so much fun to make. Sometimes albums are excruciating. They're hard work. This thing was like, I felt like I was riding a wave, you know? I sent it to Patty. I thought she was going to echo some of the lines I sang, and she was going to hit some harmony, which was very, obvious. You know, maybe she'll sing harmony here and there. This is what I'm thinking. This is the way I make a record. But no. She goes in and layers her voice, or stacks her vocals, about 12 times, and she captures the wind of the Holy Spirit on the record, you know. And then Bruce walks in. He says, "What are you doing?" And she says, "I'm doing a record with Dion." He says, "I love this song." He says, "Ask him if I could play a solo." She calls me. She says, "Bruce wants to play a solo on." I said, "Do I have to pay him?" So. I said, "Oh, okay, you could, you know." So he played a solo on it. So I got, you know, this is the fun I was having. Then I thought, well, being I asked, you know, I have Bruce and Patty. Let me call Steven Van Zandt. He's a friend. We go way back. We played together in the 70s, you know, and we've been friends all these years. So, you know, he jumped on a song called Way Down. So that's how it started, you know, and I just, and Bob, I kid you not, I just didn't send the songs out from here on in, like, to just the people because of who they were, or, you know, I was listening to stuff, and I'm a big fan of, like, Sonny Landreth's slide guitar playing. I knew the song I Got the Cure needed a slide guitar player. That I knew. And I thought, this guy is the best. And Sonny was just thrilled to do it. Samantha Fish, you know, I know she's from New Orleans. I mean, she lives that. Nobody in New Orleans plays bad. Nobody. So, I you know, she jumped on it. So it was just fun. Every time either I was in the studio with people like Little Steven and John Hammond, or I had to send them the recording, like, you know, like Brian Setzer. He was in the Midwest somewhere. I sent him Uptown Number 7. But I heard him on it. It was like a rockabilly thing, you know? So, you know, it went from there. And it was exciting, man. It was like fun. It was just, it was like every time, I got someone to contribute their vision and what they were hearing onto the track I did, it was so exciting for me because it was like a gift. It was almost like unwrapping a present or something, you know? And I found out something about myself at this age. All the years that I've been around, man, I hate to ask anybody for anything. you know, I was brought up, you know, you do it yourself, you know, like a pride thing, you know. I don't know what it was. I just never said, hey, I could use your help. Never. That would have been like, I don't know, weakness. I don't know the neighborhood I was in, this macho Italian crap, you know. I don't know what it was. But I'm telling you, did I appreciate people, these acts of service or the giving or the time they put into my thing? It was like, it was like truly a blessing.
Okay. How did you get Van Morrison and Jeff Beck on the record?
Well, I'll go with Morrison first.
Okay.
Van Morrison is my wife's favorite singer, and I know him. We go out for dinner. Every time he comes close to my house, he gives me a call.
Let's go back. How do you know Van Morrison?
I met Van Morrison back at the Spectrum in Philadelphia with the Moody Blues, back when he had, Moondance out, and we became friends.
I'm just a little more interested. So you were at the Spectrum.
We were on the show together.
Yeah. Oh, you were on the show together. Okay.
Yeah, we were backstage, and we started talking, and we both we hit it off because we both had something in common with Burt Burns, you start like bonding on people, you know, with John Lee Hooker and jazz and the horn players at the Apollo. You know, I was telling him one time, I said, Van, when I put these guys together, when I recruited what became Dion and the Belmonts, I said, the way I used to do the arrangements for The Wanderer or Runaround Sue or Ruby Baby, I said, when I heard the horn section at the Apollo, I would just try to imitate the horn section. So I'd give these guys parts, you know, like Ruby Baby. It's like, Ruby, 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 Ruby. It's like a horn section. Or The Wanderer, we're going like, da la 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 wop, ah, but it's like, da 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 da. You know, it's like horns. So when I was explaining that stuff to him, he said, man, I want to sing like a horn. I said, me too. I said, I'm a rhythm singer. I don't hold notes. I like to, you know. So I said, I'm a rhythm singer. You give me a beat. And we just bonded on that stuff, you know. And so we've been friends. So I always told my wife, I said, listen, Van Morrison and I are soul brothers, man. She said, no, he's bad. You know, she's giving me all this stuff. But she loves Van Morrison. She's like, you get in her car, she has 12 Van Morrison CDs. So she still has a CD player in her car. So anyway, I asked Van, I thought, you know, let me ask him. And I wanted him to play. Actually, I wanted him to play horn. And he said, no, I'd rather sing with you. So I wrote this song. I had this song called I Got Nothing. So I said, man, when you got Van Morrison, I told Susan, I said, man, when you sing it with Van Morrison, nothing is good enough, is more than enough. You know, I said that it was so much fun doing this record with him because, you know, he's just so free of band and he yells. He's just so he's so honest, so natural, you know. And you know, I'm like that when I'm inside a song. I just like expressing it. I don't produce anything. You know, I express it. I never sing a song the same twice, you know. So I enjoyed it. And it came out good. Came out good. Then, well, I had this beautiful ballad, Bob. It's called I Can't Get Started Again. Can't Get Started Again. I'm listening to it. I'm thinking, you know, Jeff Beck is the only guitar player that can make me cry. I mean, I've heard him do arias that from La Traviata, or, you know, I don't know. He can make me cry. So I, you know, Susan says, I don't know, Jeff Beck, you know, he's pretty much, you know, isolated out. You know, I don't know if he's going to respond. I asked him, I wrote him an email. He said, I'd love to do it. He said, in fact, I'd love to put the song on my new album. I said, you got it. So it was that simple. He was very easy to work with. He was so generous with me. It was incredible.
How do you know Jeff Beck?
Well, I met Jeff Beck at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He played a song. He did People Get Ready, you know, and he just amazed me. You know, I know him from his, you know, early recordings, whether with, you know, Mail or the, you know, people he was with early on, and, you know, followed him. And you know, he's just the gold standard bearer, because when people are in a room with Jeff Beck, they're like at attention, you know. He's just something. He does it just with his hands.
I know, no pick. It's amazing.
He's got gold in his hands. He's like, he's got a touch that, I don't know. He doesn't use effects. He doesn't use a whole lot of crazy stuff. He just plays with his hands and he gets this sound. It's just, I don't know. It's incredible. It's amazing what he does. I was just grateful to get him on the song. I'm so grateful that he said yes.
Okay. Couple of things. You are literally a legend. Do you find when you're in these situations, like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, people just are drawn to you? They want to meet you?
I don't know. I really don't know, but about that, maybe some of those guys voted for me. I really don't know, but you know, when I called Jeff Beck and started talking to him, you know, he did an album called Crazy Legs, and you know, he you know, Gene Vincent had a guitar player that never left Virginia, you know, but Jeff Beck honored him by Cliff Gallup. He honored him by doing this whole album around Cliff Gallup, because the guy was just a great player, you know. And I was talking to Jeff about that. I said, man, when you made that album, Gene Vincent must have been smiling down on you, you know, because this guy is just... So I don't know.
I think he's the best. You know, people don't really, they talk about Clapton, they talk about Hendrix. I don't care, Jimmy Page, Beck is the best.
I agree. And I love Joe Bonamassa. I think he's...
Well, that's a whole new generation.
He's got a... Yeah, well, you know, it comes down from... You got Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, and all those guys, you know, Skip James, Robert Johnson. Then you get the next generation with Jeff Beck and Clapton and Jimmy Page, and Joe Bonamassa is the new kid on the block.
Okay, you talk about all these people are literally high-profile legends themselves. You say you don't like to ask for favors, but are you someone, to use the old term, who has a pretty big Rolodex and stays in touch with these people, or is this just because you're making the album, it came together?
Yeah, a little of both. A little of both. I like John Hammond, Rory Block, you know, most of the people on here on the album, you know, I see periodically and have dinner with them and know them. But some of the people I just know, and, you know, I don't go out with them much. You know, I don't see them like daily or, you know, frequently. But you know how it is. When you have a friend, it's like you don't see him for 5 years and you pick up, it's like right there.
Right. It's like absolutely.
You didn't move an inch, you know, it's like you just continue. So, you know, it was a little of both, you know.
Okay. Now, the music business has certainly changed since you started. When it was a lot of independence and it was all about the hits. Today, even a gigantic hit is nowhere close to what it was in the 60s. People have no idea. These songs would play, everybody would know them. So when you make music today and it's harder to get the message out, and you know inherently for everybody the impact is lower, is it hard to keep your motivation?
Well, I don't know. I feel like I did more in this last year than I did in the last 20 years for some reason. But so I'm motivated just because I was like, I love talking about this album because it's, I don't feel like I'm talking about me so much. It's just that I've been surrounded by these incredible artists. So I got into their lives a little and just to appreciate what they do and being connected with them and them doing me giving me such a gift, you know. It was just a nice time of life for me, you know. It was just enjoyable, you know, to enjoy relationships like that. The impact, I know what you're talking about. You know, there was a time when you come out with an album and it sold 6 million, none of mine, but you know what I'm saying. And I don't really, like, there's a kid across the street from me. I've known him since he was born. His name is Zach Cohn. He has a group called Red Rum Society. But this kid used to come in my house. I would say, he would ask me how to play guitar, and I taught him how to play guitar. And then a couple of years ago, he said, I can't sing. I said, yeah, you could sing, Zach. I took him out on the street and we start yelling. And now he's singing. And now he has a number one EP on the blues charts, Red Rum Society. And I go to him and say, Zach, what kind of business am I in? Because now he's teaching me about I taught him about the art. He's teaching me about the business. He's teaching me about the meta tags and the analytics and on the back end of Facebook and in the back end of Instagram and all, you know, I didn't know what he was talking about, you know, but you learn about it, about these, the marketing part of it, because he's doing it alone. And, but he knows the inner workings of it, you know. So we're helping each other. It's crazy, but it's a different great. Business.
It absolutely is. Let's talk about the blues. Now, certainly all of the British guitarists were influenced by the Delta blues people, who were tend to be ignored in America till college kids picked them up in the 60s and they started to book them. Were you always a fan of the blues and these blues musicians?
No. Well, I did hear John Lee Hooker. I did hear Jimmy Reed. Jimmy Reed's part of my DNA. That's why I got into this business, Bob. Like, I heard a song by Hank Williams on my radio when I was like 10 years old. And it just, that was it.
What song was it?
It was called Honky Tonk Blues. It threw me right on the road. There was a little radio station that came out of Newark, New Jersey, the Don Larkin Show. He was an army guy and he got into country music. He was a DJ. I used to run home from junior high school just to get the last 20 minutes of it, because it was like from 3 to 4. So, this is after I heard Hank Williams. I tracked it down, who was playing it, and, you know, stuff like that. And then I went up to Fordham Road. There was in the Bronx, there was a little record shop called Cousins Record Shop. Lou Cicchetti owned it. And I asked Lou, I said, I heard a song by Hank Williams, Honky Tonk Blues. And he pulled the record out, and I went upstairs and put it on the turntable with the needle. I want this. Then I heard the back side of it, and I learned. My uncle got me a guitar, and I just was mesmerized by this stuff. You know, it's hard to explain what that does to you when you hear it, you know, like, because it threw me on a road, you know. It was so engaging. So Lou Cicchetti said, I'll just give me a number. I'll call you when every new Hank Williams song comes out. I said, please. I fell in love with this guy. Then I heard Jimmy Reed. And then I was a weird kid, man, because in my neighborhood, they were listening to Jimmy Roselli and Jerry Vale. And, you know, here I am listening to Jimmy Reed and Hank Williams, you know. And, you know, when you hear something like, you know, like Jimmy Reed, I wanted to communicate like Hank Williams, and I wanted to groove like Jimmy Reed. So that's how I got into that. And what was the question? Now I forgot.
You know, it's your affection for the blues, the generation of that and when it happened.
Yeah, well, I kind of digested that music and started to make my own records. And when I got to Run Around Sue, which is probably a cleverly disguised blues song, and Wanderer is a blues song, and Ruby Baby is a blues song, and Drip Drop is a blues song. And I was up at Columbia, and right across the hallway, which was only about 3 feet, 4 feet, they had hallways, and John Hammond Sr., his office was right across the hallway from Tom Wilson, who was producing me. He produced Dylan, too. I was the first rock and roll assigned to Columbia Records, you know, before it became Sony Records. Then John Hammond asked me one day, I was sitting on the piano bench with Aretha Franklin, and we was... I don't know. We were doing Drip Drop.
Okay, you got to tell this story. How are you sitting on the bench with Aretha Franklin, who is signed to Columbia before she goes to Atlantic and has her big hits?
Right. And they didn't know what to do with both of us. They were giving us Al Jolson songs. They gave Aretha, I don't know, you know, some kind of Rockabye My Baby with a Dixie Melody, you know. And they gave me a couple of Al Jolson songs. I liked Al Jolson. My father used to listen to him. Him I liked. He was, you know, he just had some swagger back then. You know, now it's a little corny, but he was great.
So, but tell me the story of meeting Aretha Franklin sitting on the piano bench.
We both were recording, and Bob Mercy was producing her Al Jolson songs and producing my Al Jolson songs. So we're sitting in his, I'm sitting in his office, and the piano's right near the doorway. And we're doing Drip Drop. You know, the roof is leaking and the rain's falling on my head. Drip Drop. I said the roof is leaking and the rain falling on my head. I need a mop. I cry so hard, tear rolling down my bed. Drippity drop. And you know, John Hammond walks. He says, hey. He says, come in my office when you're finished. So I walk in there, and he says, Dion, you know, you got a flair for the blues, you know? He says, I got to play it. He says, my son is getting into the blues. He said, he plays me something of his son. I said, man, that's pretty cool. He takes out the Robert Johnson album. This is 1961, Bob. This is before Clapton probably heard Crossroads. And John Hammond plays me Preaching Blues and Crossroads. And I was mesmerized. I said, I need one. You got to get me one of those albums. And I brought it home, and nobody, when I played it, they was going, what the hell are you listening to? They thought it was like Chinese music. They didn't know what the hell. I thought, you don't hear what he's doing? I thought it was unbelievable. I got crazy, and I started really getting into the, you know, I did all kinds of blues songs in the early 60s up at Columbia with the Apollo Theater guys. I did Spoonful by Howlin' Wolf early in the 60s, way before Cream or any of those guys ever touched. Now, I was up at Sirius Radio, and Peter Townsend and Roger walk in, because they heard I was doing an interview, and they said, Dion, We love that song, Spoonful. How the hell did you record that song? We want to know. I said, I was listening to Howlin' Wolf. I love the song, one of my favorite Howlin' Wolf songs. I said, I had this Birdland Gibson guitar, and I got into tremolo because of Bo Diddley, and I went up to Columbia, and I had all the guys from the Apollo Theater band there, Buddy Lucas and Styx Evans on drums and Panama Francis on percussion and all these Mickey Guitar Baker and all King Curtis, all these guys. And they would encourage me. And I said, I just said, follow me. And I sang it. I said, that's the record. So they said, that's one of our favorite records. And who the, you know, who knows, you know, after all these years, somebody tells me that, it's crazy because you never know who you're reaching or who's listening.
Well, you're at the eye of the hurricane. That's why I say if I write something, I don't know what people are talking about. People, it's the same type of thing. These records have a long life. Let's go back to you growing up, though. You go to school. Good student, bad student, popular kid, unpopular kid?
I wasn't unpopular. No, I was pretty in the mix, you know. I wasn't the greatest student. I was really good with math. I was good with math. But I had problems. I had like these, I'd get in fights and I don't know. I had these, you know, my father never had a real job. So when my uncles and everybody got together, you know, they would put him down at the dinner table. They'd be like laughing at him. And at 7 years old, I must have said to myself, nobody's ever going to treat me like that. I'll break their freaking face. You know, I got this attitude. So I was like this angry kid, like, don't ever, I'm nobody's joke. You know, I'm like, I didn't want to be treated. I must have swore an oath to heaven or, you know, vowed an oath that I got this attitude, you know. So that's what I was like a good kid. I wanted to be a good kid. I was a weird kid because I'm into Hank Williams. I'm into Jimmy Reed and I'm reading St. Thomas Aquinas. I'm like interested in blues and God. I wanted to know who God was, where he was. You know, that was my deal. So,
okay.
But I was good with sports. You know, I had good eye-hand coordination, you know, whatever sport was around. But, you know, one day I challenged this guy up at Mount St. Michael on the track, because I thought I was fast. We got on the track. I want to tell you something. I forgot about track after I raced this guy. I forgot. I said, that's not it. I'm not going there. Because I couldn't be best at it. So I picked up the guitar and I started, you know, writing or trying to do something there.
Okay, tell me more about your father. He didn't have a job. Where did the money come from? Did your mother work too?
Yeah, my mother worked hard. She was she died at 104. She worked down in the millinery district in Manhattan. She took 2-3 buses and come back and cook dinner with a coat on. She, you know, she was the hub of the family, you know, but they argued all the time because my father was like an emotional 13-year-old, you know. I don't know, maybe he was on the grid somewhere, you know. I don't know where he was at, but I got to tell you, my father had great qualities. The guy was an unbelievable athlete. He could swim, and we would go to Orchard Beach. He'd swim out to an island. He'd dive off the City Island Bridge, and then he would sculpt. He would go in the cellar and sculpt something or lift weight, but he didn't like to work.
How many kids in the family?
Three. I was the oldest. I had two sisters.
Well, usually the oldest, all the hopes and dreams are in the oldest kid, and the oldest kid gets pushed. Was that your experience?
Well, I didn't need to get pushed. I was pushing myself. I was like, I was just on a mission. The drive was on.
Okay. You know? And then was there music in the house?
My father listened to Al Jolson. He listened to Louis Prima. I always say Louis Prima would be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame if he didn't sing Italian songs. Because Sam Butera was one of the best sax players I've ever heard. You know, the guy, he was just great.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Okay, I'm a little younger than you, but I'm certainly aware, and one of the big things they always said was street corner singing. What was really going on there? Were you really singing on the street corners?
Absolutely. Where else? Hallways. When we found out the hallways had a better sound, we got into the hallways or the subway stations. But we would sing anywhere, you know, on the stoops mostly, you know. Yeah. Absolutely. It was street music. You know, we weren't on stage. We didn't have a studio. It was like, it was street music. We'd get together and make up sounds, you know. You know, dead, lead, 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 lead. Yeah. Dead, lead, 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 lead. Yeah. You know, dom, 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 and just jump on it with some harmony and It was an art form, you know.
And at what point do you say, I can make this a career, I can earn a living at this?
Well, I went down to a little company. There was a black guy in my neighborhood. His name was Willie Green. He was the janitor of one of the apartment buildings. I couldn't wait to get with him after school. Because he played guitar and he listened to John Lee Hook. I love this guy. Man, you know, I just couldn't wait to get with him. You know, it was the real deal for me. It was stuff that made me feel alive, you know. So then I found out that there was this company and they wanted me to audition. There was a songwriter in the neighborhood, not a very good one, but he knew this company. And he said, you should go down here and audition. He got me an audition. And I was kind of frightened about it. And I told Willie Green, this janitor, he said, just be yourself. He said, sing that Carl Perkins song you sang for me, you know. So I went down there and I did that. And I got a record deal. And I didn't know what I was doing. I just, you know, they signed me right away. So then they wanted to, they put me with this group from Oklahoma called the Timberlands, you know, like, do 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 do, you know, like, you know, like, I said, I can't sing with these guys. So that was how I recruited all the best, you know, street doo-wop singers from the streets, you know, that used to hang out in different neighborhoods, listening to different jukeboxes. And I got the best, you know, the best of the best, and put them together. They came over my house one day and we put I Wonder Why together. Bob, you should have been there. I'm telling you, it was like a dream come true. I don't know. I wasn't into doo-wop that much. I mean, I never sang with three other guys in the room. I had a guitar and I would do Hank Williams songs or something. But being this company wanted to, you know, put me with this group, the Timberlands, and they did. I recorded something and I just didn't like it. I said, you know, let me try it. Being you want this, I'll get some guys. I'll do anything, you know, because I would do anything to make a record or, you know, be an artist. So I got these guys and we put this song together. And the first day we sang that song in my parents' apartment, in my bedroom, those three guys, it was like I was on a carousel in heaven. One guy was singing, the other guy's going, woo, and the other guy, you know, and I'm singing lead. We were doing four different things. It was like Dixieland, but it was our own thing. But it was amazing. It was like a golden moment, a real defining moment in my life.
Okay. You have success. What would you consider to be your first big hit record?
I think that. I Wonder Why.
Okay. So if we go with Wonder Why, you cut it in the studio and they used to cut really fast. Did you know it was going to be as big as it ended up being?
No, but I knew we had something special. I liked it. I thought it was pretty cool. It was different. You know, the intro to it is as distinctive as for doo-wop as Chuck Berry's intro to Johnny B. Goode on guitar.
Okay, but you're a young guy. You're living in the Bronx. Everybody's listening to the radio. What's it like when your song comes over the radio? What are the kids in the neighborhood saying? What do you think?
Bob, it was crazy because, you know, we didn't have air conditioners. So everybody had their windows open in the summer, right? They're just, you know, and the radios are on. And they know that Dion and the Belmonts, they know I'm Francis's kid, Pat and Francis's kid, and I got a record out. So everybody's listening to the countdown. Everybody listened to the same music back then. We didn't have all these stations. Now you look, they have like 50 genres. No, everybody listened to the same stuff. So I Wonder Why comes on. It was surround sound coming out of everybody's window. So, you know, and out of the convertibles in the street. So it was amazing. We bought jackets and we painted Dion and the Belmonts on the back. You know, we were crazy. So it was a lot of fun.
Okay, but then you go on an incredible run, both with and without the Belmonts. And you're a young guy. How do you handle that emotionally?
You know, Bob, I couldn't handle my emotions for, I didn't even know what they were, where they came from. So, I started, you know, like a lot of people, I started with the drinking and the drugging. And I started pretty young. Actually, I started before I was recording. I started fooling with drugs when I was 14. And, you know, so I wanted to accomplish something with the singing and the contract and the records. But really, I my feet were firmly planted on in the air. You know, I had no I had no foundation at all. So it's crazy. And I you know, I got, you know, with that stuff, it's progressive and you get hooked. And the mid 60s were, you know, I always say there's three stages to drug addiction or alcoholism and all that kind of stuff. The first stage goes up. It's a lot of fun. You think you found heaven. The second stage is it flattens out. It's like fun and some problems. And then the third stage is nothing but problems. So that's how it went for me. The mid, you know, when I was at Columbia, I was, it was fun, and then it got fun and some problems. And, you know, like that.
Okay. So you go on the road, you're a young success. Do you partake of all of the goodies on the road? Not only the drugs, but the sex, et cetera?
You know, I was a shy kid, man. I was shy, so I wasn't, you know, it just wasn't part of my nature to I wanted to, you know, and I did, but I wouldn't say it was like overboard. I was like, I'd meet somebody, you know, if it happened, it happened. But, you know, I mean, yeah, you know, it's funny. I go back to the St. Thomas Aquinas that I was reading. It's funny how things affect you when you're older and you're having problems emotionally and you're taking drugs, because I started thinking about St. Thomas Aquinas, and I started thinking about some of the things I learned, and I you know, it's Aquinas would say, if you don't have God in your life, you have to fill up on something. And it's usually the four substitutes, the typical temptations or addictions. It's wealth, pleasure, power, and honor. And you got to get the money, the pleasure, sex, drugs, rock and roll. You got to get, you know, you could see the politicians with the power. People got power. That's a big addiction. And honor. You got to be right. You got to win. You got to be better. You got all this stuff. So you try to fill yourself up with that stuff. And it doesn't really work because it's outside yourself. You know, you're really not finding, it'll never satisfy that deep longing of your heart and spirit, you know? So I started to think about these things when I started getting addicted, you know, when I was miserable, you know, coming into 1968, I started thinking about the Monsignor who stopped me on the street one day, and he said, "Yo, Dion, come over here. What makes a man happy?" And I said, "Monsignor, if I could get a Thunderbird, if I could get a Gibson J200 guitar, if I could get a hit record," I'm talking about when I was 15 years old. I said, "If I could get a date with that girl, Susan, who moved down from Vermont, I'd be a happy guy." He said, "No, Dion, the virtuous man is a happy man." I said, "What the hell is virtue?" I had no idea what it was because I was up to no good. And he said, "It's a habitual and firm disposition to do the good." I mean, I remembered it because we sat there for 20 minutes and he drilled it into my head. And I was up to no good. So, but later on, when I'm hooked and baffled and wondering about, you start thinking about these things. Gee, maybe what he said was, I wonder how you get there, you know? And then I met a guy. I was like, you know, I had 12 gold records on the wall, and I had a, you know, I had success, Run Around Sue and The Wanderer and Root. I had some big records with Teenager in Love as a kid. And then it rolls around 1968, and February of 1968, Frankie Lyman dies of an overdose. And I ran the streets with Frankie Lyman. We used to like take drugs together and stuff. And it just scared me. I thought, you know, this is not going to end up well. So I got on my knees one night, and like, that's why I said it was like December 14th. I got on my knees and I asked God for help. I said, God, I don't know if you're real. I don't know what's going on, but I need help. I'm telling you, I haven't had a drug or a drink in 52 years. So that was my deal. Then I meet this guy and I'm having coffee with him. I don't know if you want to hear this, but
no, keep going.
But this is crazy, you know, because I'm from the streets, man. I'm from Crotone Avenue in the Bronx. We don't talk about this stuff. Nobody says, are you serene, or how do you find peace of mind? You know, who the hell cares? You know, nobody's thinking like that. But this guy says to me, do you know where feelings come from? I said, no. He said, they come from your thinking, your thought. You will feel what you're thinking. Now, who the hell ever knew that? I didn't know that. So now, if I get off someday, like a little, which I don't, I'm a funny guy, because if you would open up my brain, if you would open up, saw my head in half and look inside my brain, you'd see a very peaceful, orderly place. So, and that's because of this guy who told me that. Because, he was like into pursuing wisdom, you know, cultivating the life of the mind. He used to say, this is where you live, in your mind. You live here. You know, you got to be right, because I was a mess. I was a mess, Bob, you know. But thank God, I think from that point on, well, I've always had this. I got to say, I've always had this wonderful gift to surround myself with great people that knew more than I did, much more than I did. I don't know what that, and I'm not saying all the time I was around, you know, there were people coming in out of my life that weren't like that, but the people that I really appreciated, I had this ability to notice that I wanted to be this guy's friend. You know, he could take me to higher ground.
Okay. Mentally, let's say, you know? Look, let's say hypothetically tomorrow you went to the doctor and he said you have a year to live. Tragically, but it's not really happening. Would you partake of drugs and alcohol, or would you stay off?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely stay clean. No, I'm high. I'm like I'm a very grateful guy. I wouldn't want to be any other place than in the presence of beauty and awe and wonder and life and I and my friends. No.
Okay. You become sober in 68. That's very early, you know, so being sober today is a big thing, but certainly as someone like me who gave up alcohol in 1981, for years, people are cajoling me, have a drink. Did you experience that?
Yeah, but, it's not something I got rid of or something. It's just something that, I don't want. I don't need to go there. I don't need to feel better than I feel. I like to feel what I'm feeling. I like to experience life in a very real way, on a higher reality. It's just to me, it's the real deal. It's something. And drugs or alcohol, I want to be fully alive, and that's not the way to go. If you want to be,
I'm totally with you. There's no drug I've ever taken that's as good as a natural high. May sound like a cliche, but I firmly believe that.
No, and look, it's been 52 years. I have three daughters that love me dearly. They walk in the house, they want to lean on my shoulder and hug me, and they don't feel judged. I don't judge them. I enjoy them. I have a wife, that girl, Susan. I told you, I met her when I was 14. She's still my wife. Been married 57 years. I'm like, if I had 1 year to live, I'd probably get closer to my friends and closer to the people I love. But I wouldn't, you know, drugs and alcohol would take you further away from that. So I wouldn't even think of that.
Okay, so when you...
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Started out, the package tour was the big thing. What were those days like?
Well, I tell you something, I learned a lot. Because, you know, back in those days, well, even today, the music brought the races together, brought different cultures together. You know, I traveled with Bobby Blue Bland, I traveled with Sam Cooke. I'll tell you a story. I put in there's a song, actually, Songwriters of America picked it as the best song of 2020. It's called Song for Sam Cooke, Here in America. And what the song comes out of is, and Paul Simon helped, is on it. He sang some harmony with me, who made it just really something special. But when I met Sam Cooke, I traveled with Sam Cooke for a month on a big show called Show of Shows. I forget something like that. I forget the name of the tour. But we traveled all over the country, and then we went on another tour, and we were down in Memphis. And he was a very refined guy, Sam Cooke, very intelligent. You know, I was rough. I was rough around the edges. I was a kid from the Bronx. You know, he was a preacher's kid. And I saw him in a lot of different situations in Memphis. And people were, you know, there was racism in New York, but it wasn't the same because I was, like I told you, I was at Columbia Records with all the Apollo guys, you know, and I was friends. I became friends with Buddy Lucas for all his life, you know, and Sam, you know, they had the Jim Crow laws down there. I who knew anything about that? You know, that was a whole different thing for me. So when I saw people treating him the way they treated him, he was a very beautiful guy, statuesque. He was tall. He was stood straight. He was bright. You wanted to be around them. You know, like I said, you could learn from guys like this. So I would, you know, he taught me basically that racism was a, you know, a peculiar way to become a man. And if race mattered to you, basically I learned it from him. If race matters to you, if it's significant to you, you're a racist. It didn't matter to us. it doesn't matter to you and me. It's like eye color or shoe color, you know? So I would watch this guy and I'd say, Sam, why don't you punch that guy in his face? You know, and he'd say, Dion, you know, why should I get down on that level? So I got to observe him in a lot of different situations and the way he responded. And I never seen him get ruffled. I've never seen him get angry. I've seen him say things that were like incredible to just deflective stuff that would like put in somebody's face, like put up a mirror in somebody's face to show them where they were really at. And I would think, what the hell, and then it dawned on me after about 3 weeks that he was the smartest guy in the room, but he never let you know it. He was that smart. He didn't even have to go there. These people were idiots, you know? So he wanted to, and he would talk about God, and he would talk about brotherhood and friendship and understanding. He was like living out the gospel. He would understand me. He stood up for me. Sam Cooke took me to a club in Memphis to see James Brown and the Flames. And people were getting on my case, and he'd say, "Hey, he's the kid's with me. That's Dion. You know, we're doing shows together." But he was a good guy. So I wrote this song years ago, and I never recorded it. It's called "Song for Sam Cooke." And last year, when I saw Green Book, I said to my wife, "Wow, they wrote a song. They put a movie together. It reminds me of my song. You know, it's like backwards, but it." It reminds me of my song. So I took the song out and it ended up on Blues with Friends. And when I played it for Paul Simon, you know, he mentioned racism. He said a song. I said, it's not really. I said, yes, there's a racism component to it, but it's really a song about brotherly love and friendship and understanding. And he said, yeah, I get it. So. We did it together.
Okay. Who turned you on to heroin? What were the circumstances there?
One day, you know, the idea of that, I was young and my parents were always arguing, always, man, just 24/7. My father never had a job and they would, you know, just be at it all the time. So the first time I snorted some of this stuff, I was like, whoa. I was on the street the next day looking for it. I want more of that. It made me feel good, period. And that's what happens, you know. I just felt good.
Okay. So tell us your version of splitting up with the Belmonts.
My version is the real reason. You know, we did the first album and I had this love for Hank Williams and Jimmy Reed. And these three guys that I put together started wanting to do, I don't know what they were, you know, because people back then talked about legitimate music. Like I Wonder Why wasn't legitimate. And they wanted to do stuff like the four tops. I don't know, like the Letterman. I forget. You know, it was like these groups that sang smooth harmonies, and we did a whole album of these songs. I guess from the Great American Songbook. You know, the Swinging on a Star and. You know, in the Still of the Night, not the five satins in the Still of the Night, but you know, some of the like Where or When. We had a hit record called Where or When because it was I did it because of it was the record company president's favorite song, so I put a version of that together. Then they wanted to sing everything like that, and I said I can't do that. I just can't do that. I'll blow my brains out. So we just split. And that's how I got to make Run Around Sue and The Wanderer and everything, you know, because if I would have stayed with them, I would have been, if I would have stayed with that, not basically with them. I loved the guys. They were great talents in the guys in the Belmonts. They were great, great singers. I loved them, you know, and it was humble to sing with them. But the music, I wanted to do what I wanted to do. It was like, it was driving me. I had no choice. I really didn't have a choice. And I'm still doing it. And I still don't have a choice. And
What was the difference between being on Lori Records and an independent and being on Columbia?
I got to say, there wasn't too much difference. They both were, I tell you the way it was back then, they both were with me. Okay, you want to do that song, Ruby Baby? Do this song. We'll make you do one song that you want to do one song that we want you to do. So it was like one for you, one for me. Same with Lori Records. That was it. So, you know, I didn't know any better, you know, but when I got a little older, when I started getting like, I was about 23, I just, I left Columbia. I left a lot of money on the table. I came home and I told my wife, Susan, I said, I left. I can't, they're not going to release the Kickin' Child album. They don't like, and it's a great album. They just released it recently, and it was a great album. Did it all live with I don't know, just live, right in the studio. Four guys with Al Cooper on keyboards, and Tom Wilson produced it. But I told Susan, I left Columbia. I left the money there, you know, and I had a contract on hand. I was making $100,000 a year for 5 years. That was the contract I signed. And I left within 2 years. I left $300,000 on the table. I said, keep it. That's how much the music meant to me. That's how much I just couldn't do it. It was the only thing I had in my that was my salvation, was this gift, you know, that was in me. So I never lost my artistic curiosity. And I feel like the same as when I was a kid, you know. I like coming out on the stage with a guitar and just rocking, you know, and just doing a great song and taking people on a trip. But it's gotta be from the inside of you. How are you gonna do it with somebody else telling you to? It just doesn't work. You know, do it with this song. No, I don't think so.
Okay, what was your perspective when the Beatles arrived and the whole British invasion? What do you think of that?
Well, I didn't, to be honest with you, the Beatles didn't affect me one bit. I didn't even, to me, I don't even call it the British invasion. I call it the British infusion, because I got into the Stones and the, you know, and some of the stuff they were doing, like the Animals, you know, with House of the Rising Sun. The Beatles were like too cute. I love you. Yeah. Yeah. Woohoo. You know, I was like, nah, later for that stuff. I it was too many chords, too cute for me. I didn't get into it, but you know, I came to appreciate them when they did Rubber Soul. They were writing some great songs, you know, and then Revolution, you know, but it wasn't like anything that threatened me. You know why it didn't bother me? Because I mean, it didn't affect me, because I was in my room after I heard John Hammond, after he gave me an armful of albums of Furry Lewis and Fred McDowell and Lightning Hopkins and Robert Johnson. I was in my room. I love Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan came to Columbia. I was at a lot of the early sessions, just sitting there with John Hammond. But I tell you, I loved him. That was incredible. But that's what I was into. I was into the blues. I loved Dylan. You know, I got into a lot of the people in the Village that were down there, like Tim Hardin. I was watching the Lovin' Spoonful creation, you know, Richie Havens, John Hammond Jr. playing at the Gaslight, hanging out there, Paul Butterfield. Yeah. So the Beatles, and not to make it sound trite or like, you know, like I'm putting them, but I it wasn't for me. Okay. I was more in the blues and the folk thing, you know, the
okay. Tell us the story of Abraham, Martin, and John.
You know, I was living in Miami. I had moved there, a geographical cure, because I had been drinking and drugging. And I was, like I said, I ended up there. Frankie Lyman died. I was in Miami. And I met a guy and introduced me to a spiritual 12-step program, and I got into that, and I never looked back. I got on my knees one night. I've never been the same. I took to it like a duck to water, you know. So I was working on myself and working on my, you know, putting things back together mentally for myself, because I had taken drugs and was drinking for quite a while, that this song, it comes to me, Abraham, Martin, and John. 3 months after I cleaned up, you know, after I stopped drinking and drugging. And Dick Holler walks in into my house, says, you know, he wrote it, and he wrote it kind of like cutesy, dude, you know. So I picked up my guitar. I had a gut string guitar, and I kind of arranged it, you know, I put it together in a way that I thought would be interesting, because I was listening to Tim Hardin back then, Kenny Rankin, you know. So I don't know. I thought, let me try it like this. I put the song together, and I recorded it for Laurie Records. Well, when I started playing it, my wife said, wow, that's the gospel. She said, that sounds like you could kill the dreamer, but you cannot kill the dream. You know, it's people like us, we pick up on it and carry it further. She said, so I'll keep you in my prayers, do a good job with it. I went up to New York, got in the studio with, the studio was loaded with musicians. I did the song with my gut string guitar, and it who knew? Because that was, you know, in that era, that was Jimi Hendrix, Cream, Eric Clapton, you know, stuff like that. I would never think it would even, you know, I just recorded it because it was interesting, but I who would think it would become like an anthem, or, you know, a song that would, you know, go to number one.
Okay. You were one of the first, if not the first, mainstream rocker to make Christian music. So can you tell me about that process and how you flipped back and forth from Christian to secular music thereafter?
Well, to me, you know, it's like, to me that, I don't even know if it makes sense, but, you know, if you go in a record store, they'll have these different bins: Christian music, folk music, blues, rock and roll. To me, when I pick up a guitar, it's Dion music. So, you know, I wanted to sing a gospel tune. I got into gospel music. I was listening to some of the groups and Mighty Clouds of Joy, and I heard something. I thought, this is great. And, you know, and I thought, hey, I don't mind being identified with Jesus, because, you know, here's a man, God man, who cared about the sick, the lonely, the broken, the disabled, you know, the poor. I said, I don't mind being identified with him. So I thought, that's an uplifting thing for me, and a good way to go. So I wrote a lot of gospel songs, a lot. I think I made 5 albums. It was, to me, it was very uplifting. It was like, you know, it just was, it had a lot to do with just what was happening inside of me at the time.
Okay. Now, when you started in the record business, royalties were low. They tended not to be paid. And a lot of these hit records you didn't write. So how has the money worked out over all these decades?
With me?
Yeah.
You know, I'm blessed, man. I'm blessed. I tell you, a lot of guys don't end up in good shape, but I don't know. I reeled in all the publishing that I wrote about 400 songs. So, man, mailbox money is good for me. I mean, it keeps me buoyant. You know, I have no complaints. I never have to claim bankruptcy or, you know, I don't know. I'm a generous guy, but I always been like, I didn't need to be fancy. I didn't need to have a car every year or to live. I never had to show anybody anything. You know, I never had to be extravagant. Like, I just wasn't that guy. So I ate well. I lived well. I don't feel like I'm lacking anything. You know, my wife and I could help my kids. I could do a lot, you know, but I ended up in a good place because of a great manager, Dick Fox. He is a blessing. He was like Mother Teresa to me. You know, he came into my life and I had a good guy by my side and who didn't rip me off or, you know, because I come from the era that, you know, clever accounting. You're always in the red. I never made any money on albums. Never. I never.
And you still don't get any record royalties?
But yes, through Sound Exchange, through ASCAP, thank God, that the publishing, you know, I talked to Lou Reed a long time ago. He said, publishing, that's your retirement plan there. So my wife ran the publishing company for about 25 years. So to be honest with you, I did well. I do well.
But when was the last, have you ever gotten a royalty on a record from the label?
That's another situation, you know, but I'll tell you what, you get ripped off, absolutely ripped off. Okay. But I'll tell you something, especially from, you know, from that decade, you know, now it's a different story. I'm like with much honest, more honest and upfront people that show you everything. But, back in that day, everybody got ripped off. I mean, Chuck Berry, Bo Dylan, you talk to all these guys, everybody got, you know, didn't get paid. But somewhere along the line, the idea comes to you, let me pull back from this. Like if I'm, say, take Muddy Waters, comes out of the fields, he's picking cotton, gets his guitar, walks into his studio, you know, Chess Records. And say he doesn't get paid. Okay. If you approach the guy like that and say, hey, listen, Muddy, we are going to record you and we're going to give you an international career. The world is going to know you. And, you know, you're going to make money because you're going to be the man, you know. We're going to give you a career. We're going to give you a 60-year career. What do you think of that? Who wouldn't sign on? I'd say, yeah. So somewhere along the line, you pull back and you look at this and you go, well, yeah, I didn't get paid correctly in it, but look, they took a shot with me. They gave me this and they were like that. And you just, I mean, not that it's right, but you walk away without a resentment and you don't have to ruin your life thinking about people beating you and all that stuff and blaming people, you know, you just, so You know what I'm saying? You got to pull back and look at the whole picture.
Okay. And how did you meet, hook up with Dick Fox?
He was a fan as a kid. And when I was in, he showed up when I was going through a difficult time. And he said, I'd love to manage you. This was like in the early 90s. And I've been with him ever since. And he's made my life a living dream. Thank you, Dick Fox. Thank you, God. I mean, you know, when you got a guy like that by your side, what it's just, it makes life, it just makes life wonderful.
Okay, now you moved to Miami in 68. What do we know about Miami? Snowbirds went there. Jackie Gleason moved there. But maybe with Criteria Studios in the 70s, Miami became hot. Nothing like it is today. Were you out of the loop? It was good for you for drugs and alcohol. Was it good for you musically?
Well, I really was still connected to New York. I moved down just to get away from drugs and alcohol, and I found out that I took myself with me. But as you'd have it, you know, I met a guy and I got clean and sober. I've been clean and sober ever since April of 1968. And that's a big thing. It kept me healthy and vital and significant, you know, like I made this latest album, Blues with Friends. You'd think I'd go in and make an album if I didn't feel, you know, significant or had something to say. What would be the reason to do it? I don't have a reason, you know. So I feel very alive and well. And like, I have more to say now than I did when I was 19. I made some great records then, but you should hear the new thing I'm doing. I just went in and cut it. I'm cutting a new album. I must be under the spout where the glory comes out because, man, these songs are getting downloaded in my head. So I'm excited about this new thing I'm doing. You know, it's just fun. I love, you know, Bob, I've always loved creating something like it wasn't there and all of a sudden it's there. The sound, these songs, they take people on a trip. I've always loved that more than going on the road and singing and, you know, and doing that deal. I love singing to people. It's just wonderful to see the faces. And like I said, I've never changed. I love taking people on a trip, but let me tell you, man, I love the idea of creating more than anything. It's just, that turns me on. That floats my boat. That's why I'm still passionate.
Okay. You've had ups and downs. You talk about alcohol, moving to Miami. Do you ever contemplate giving up?
Giving up?
Yeah. Retiring, doing something else.
I don't know. You know, I'll be honest with you. I love talking to men about recovery. I mean, that'll always be a part of my life because someone was there for me and showed me where the key was to open up the cell that I was in of self-bondage, you know? And so I just love talking to men because when I see the lights come on, they come alive and they get free. A freedom of excellence, a genuine freedom, not false. And their families come together and their kids, and that turns me on. So I would never retire from that, and I would never retire. I don't think I could ever retire from making music some way, you know. And so those two things, like. You know, Bob, I found out a long time ago, there's a big difference between success and fulfillment. And, you know, they're not the same. They're different. And, you could just read the headline. You could just read the tabloids and see people that are successful. A lot of them are not very happy. So, But I'm a grateful guy because I found peace and brotherhood with a lot of friends and community and love around me. So I'm good to go day at
okay.
a time.
But before you go, on every level, your mother lived to 104. Let's just say you have 20 years left. Anything specific you want to accomplish? Or do with that time?
Well, you know, I'll tell you something that's crazy. It's crazy because I'm from New York, right? But John Coltrane is a quote that really hit me. He said, the only real regret in life is not to become a saint. Now, you know, you would think, well, what do I want to accomplish? What do I want to do? Well, that's not a bad mission statement, to try and let go of all the things that get in the way of a terrible life, you know, all the addictions and, kind of missing the mark and trying to get all the, you know, being self-centered and all that, you know, to try and shoot for something like that. That would be my mission statement, to try. You know, listen, I got friends that'll look at me and go, ain't going to happen. You know, listen, I'll never be, you know, none of us are going to be perfect. None of us. But it's not a bad thing to shoot for, like perfection and to be a good person. I always say, I'm a thinker, you know, I like to think. So I always say, God without goodness is fanaticism. And goodness without God doesn't endure for very long. It has no legs. So I have all these kind of things I got in my head, you know, that keep me on track. You know, I got good people around me, you know.
Do you play music in the house on a regular basis, either records or playing yourself?
Yeah, I don't. There's no music blasting in my house all the time, but, you know, I have earphones. I get in the truck and I like to play what I like in the truck and not bother, you know, but I write in the house. I'm always, you know, in a room with my guitar and, because I tell you, I have no choice. These songs get dropped in your head, Bob. You know, it's just something, it's a gift, right? It's a gift because it comes out of the wellspring of creativity, and I'm under it. I just stay under it.
And now we are all under it. You're a fount of wisdom and insight, and you have survived, unlike Frankie Lyman. Thanks so much for taking the time, Dion.
Hey, Bob, thank you. We got to work together. You stay well, stay safe, stay strong, stay well.
Thanks for the positive words, because we both been through it, but I've certainly been through it. Till next time, this is Bob Lefsetz.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.